I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking hour?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Hi, I'm Joe Palmer. I'm the Chief Executive of AFC Wimbledon, and I'd really love you to invest in the bond options that we have at the moment at ploughlanebond.com.
So tell us a bit about how, firstly, your interest in football started when you were young, and secondly, how you got to the point, Joe, where you thought, I'm going to work in it.
Yeah, so I guess my interest in football was fairly standard of any other young boy who watched football and played football. I became hooked on Spurs when I was a boy, and in particular the 1987 FA Cup final, which we unfortunately lost.
I see you're in good company. We had Clive Allen on this before.
I know. Well, he was my idol as well. I mean, what a season he had that year.
Incredible.
And it was that really, I think what really cemented myself in my love of football at that point was, you know, was the emotion I had on that day. It was the first time I ever cried at sport, you know, when we lost. Particularly when we absolutely should not have done, but fair credit to Coventry. It's quite interesting actually, because a few years later, obviously, as we'll come on later, we'll talk about Sheffield Wednesday, I got to meet Chris Waddle, and we were having breakfast one day, and just at the end of it, I had to ask him. I said, what happened in that 87 final? Why did you lose it? And he said, well, we'd played, I can't remember the number now, something like 58 games that season, something ridiculous, you know, yeah, in total, because they were in all competitions and did really well.
Yeah, semis of the League Cup, there was a replay in it as well, yeah, wasn't there? Yeah.
And he said, we were knackered. He said, we were just absolutely knackered for that game. And he said, it showed, and you know, he said, when you watch it back, you can just see people were very tired. Mm. I guess that happens, isn't it? You know, that's the price of success sometimes, isn't it? And when your most important game comes and you've participated that much throughout the season, you're exhausted. So, but yeah, that really is where it came from. And I was at, my idol was Glenn Hoddle, and what a fantastic player he was. So that's really where it sort of started, and then built from there, I guess. And
so, when did you realise that a career in sport would be possible?
I guess it was sort of through my sort of teenage years, and as you know, you go through your options and what you're going to do and with your life. And I was sort of looking at the kind of PE teacher sort of role, and then
okay,
sort of got into clearing. I was going to go into sports science, was my background. So I did really well in my A levels with my PE course there, and that really sort of hooked me in, because I really enjoyed it. Was the first time I actually really enjoyed a subject I was doing, and obviously not just from the practical side of view, actually what I was learning about, you know, sports science, physiology, history, you know, sporting culture, all that type of stuff was really fascinating to me. So I always had that, from that point, I had that idea that I would then progress. And then I sort of had a bit of a U-turn moment where I decided, actually, I didn't think there was enough money in PE teaching. Yeah. So I decided to study advertising at university, and obviously went forward with that. And when I come back from traveling and started discussing what I was going to do, got into agency work, advertising agencies, PR agencies, and was working there for about five or six years. Yeah. And then it just sort of clicked one day. I thought, well, hang on, sports marketing agencies, marrying of sport, marrying of marketing and advertising, that thing, putting them together. Yeah. So I decided to set up my own sports marketing consultancy to bring kind of my passion with what I knew.
Well, I guess we're of a, I can tell from your footballing touchstones that we're of a similar sort of age. And I guess for our generation, it's a very interesting time to have supported football and to have followed football, because almost as you're a mid-teenager becoming an adult, that's when football starts to become a really commercial concern and starts to move into wholly different circles.
Absolutely. You know, I think, you know, in the past, people wouldn't have considered it, you know, and there was a real boom, particularly with sports marketing, you know, and things like, you know, players, you know, their rights, you know, and understanding all these deals that were taking place, you know, back in the days of the Galacticos and stuff like that. And it just really went to another stratosphere, if you like. And sports marketing agencies were popping up all over the place. And it was about monetizing football outside of what you saw on the stadium, you know, just some advertising around the stadium, a bit on the shirts. This suddenly catapulted into another realm. And it was right at that time, you know, when I was sort of considering what I was going to do, and obviously working within marketing and advertising. So it obviously seemed like a very logical step, and a step that was actually achievable for me. To you know, I think it would be anyone's dream to be able to marry up their passion with what they know and their skills. So obviously took on that opportunity and had an agency in London for 5 years, and worked with Portsmouth Football Club, worked with the Football Foundation.
So when did you set that up?
So that was in 2005.
Okay.
Yeah, had a great time with that. You know, probably didn't know as much as I thought I did. So it was a real, you know, learning on the job type thing, but it was great, you know. And, you know, we did things like the Ladies European Golf Tour as well, and worked for London United Basketball Club. So it was a variety, it was a cross sport, which was really interesting for me.
And then you went on to work with MUTV as well, at Manchester United.
MUTV was before that. That was actually my first, that's probably what really sprung that desire inside me, was because at the PR agency I was working, for that became one of my first jobs, and my role there was effectively basically calling up MUTV. They would then play an exclusive interview down the phone to me, which I'd record on my dictaphone, sort of showing the leaps in technology from since then.
All very club cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Listen to it, and then I would call up the Sun or the Mirror and say, look, I've got an exclusive, you know, I'll give it to you if you'll give me plug MUTV, basically. Mm. So I would then play the interview down the phone to them, usually one of the Custis brothers, and they would then put it into the paper.
I suppose that's quite ahead of its time, really, isn't it? I mean, when you think of you know, football exploding in the 90s commercially, post Premier League 1992, and United were absolutely at the vanguard of that, weren't they? And it's something that, you know, is seen as, you see more and more in recent years, don't you? Like football clubs saying, you know, it's exclusive. Well, of course it's an exclusive, they're your players. Mm. But like Manchester United, I guess a little bit ahead of the curve, like thinking of that 20 years ahead of where we are now.
100%. I mean, it was, you know, it was unheard of, really. You know, I mean, don't get me wrong, they put a big investment into that. I mean, it's not something you consider lightly. TV channel is huge. It had an entirely different staff, you know, and offices and infrastructure. It was a massive organisation. But like I said, it really was quite special for the club because it made them very unique. But like I said, from the point of view of those interviews, you got an interview with, you know, Beckham or Ferguson, I mean, people would bite your hand off to get, you know, get something exclusive like that from them, and it would fill the back page, you know, when we got it on. So yeah, it was a real coup for Man United, and it really, again, it was just a part of that time when they really just took a step beyond everybody else.
So we get to 2009, and how does the move to Shakhtar Donetsk come about?
So so it was one of those sort of chance kind of encounters. So just through a friend of mine, they knew a guy from Ukraine that was over here studying at Birkbeck College, and he was looking to bring some sports marketing expertise out to Ukraine because it really was very underdeveloped at that time. So I said, sure, I'll meet this guy. Met him, had a discussion. He said, look, why don't you come out to Ukraine, let's see what we can do. So I agreed, so I went out. We met some football clubs, we met tennis clubs, we met Chigirinsky, the footballer who was at Shakhtar Donetsk, and started discussions, particularly with him, in relation, because Shakhtar had just won the UEFA Cup, and he then got a move to Barcelona. So we were right there at that time, and we were looking to help do a boot deal for him. So it was really interesting, you know, thinking where we could go. And then when I came out the second time, I actually had a chance meeting with the lawyer from Shakhtar, and the guy that had brought me out there, Yuri, sort of said, you know, let's go and speak to Zorya Luhansk, another club out there. And he mentioned to the lawyer that we were discussing about developing strategy for clubs out there and how they could improve their commercialization, improve their attendances, all this sort of stuff. And he said, well, why don't you come talk to us? We're looking for that. We're looking to develop our strategy. Will you come and talk to us? So I said, yep. I then flew out to Switzerland to meet the chief executive, Sergei Palkin. And had a conversation about him. He explained sort of the structure of the club, the fact that they'd just built the Donbass Arena, this wonderful new stadium. And would I, you know, could I come and help them develop a strategy for the club to take it to the next step? They just obviously won the UEFA Cup, you know, 6 months earlier.
And looking to establish themselves in the Champions League.
Exactly.
Yeah.
To take to a next level. So, you know, we had a brief discussion. Sort of explained to me the kind of terms of that. And I said, yeah, I'd relish the opportunity to come and do that. So out I went there in the height of winter. And I remember stepping off the plane in there, and it was minus 18. And I was thinking, where on earth have I come to? I knew it was going to be a little bit different. I then spent the next sort of 6 months doing an audit of the club. I mean, it's a huge club. It's very difficult to articulate the scale of it. I mean, it had, in terms of full-time staff, you're talking 450 people, which is, you know, five times more than most football clubs. and over a vast area, huge stadium, wonderful training base. I mean, one of the best training bases in Europe, one of the best stadiums in Europe. But effectively, they didn't really know how to optimise it. So that was sort of my plan, was I went round, spoke to all the department heads, and started to build a picture of what the club was, then understand what the possibility of the club was. Where could it really go? Where could it really achieve? Based on largely the main objectives that the owner had really set for the club. He wanted to be one of the top clubs in Europe. That was his idea. So it was really about, how do you make that happen? How do you go back step by step from where we are now to effectively be able to say that about the club?
Because they were always keen in investing, and Akhmatov invested a lot of his own money, didn't he? And I guess for you, it must have been an eye-opener, like not only how big the club was, but how keen they were to make it happen. I mean, I think people look sometimes at players like Fernandinho and Willian and wonder, why did they stay so long? But frankly, they've given a very, very comfortable life. They're a hugely ambitious club. They're paid very well. They're looked after. And they have this mini community around them. So I guess the difference is, from what you're saying, it's turning that willingness to invest into actual results through your know-how.
Absolutely. That's absolutely right. And Akhmetov was, you know, the perfect owner in that sense. He really understood what it took. He understood the value of foreign input, in not just in his football club, but all his businesses. So all his major companies would have foreign directors or strategists that would come in to help take those businesses to another level. So he is simply applying the same philosophy in the football club. So we had obviously Dutch guys that created the academy, and obviously brought me on from the business side to take that on. And really, what was so great about it was that the stadium really was, and the business was, a blank canvas. You know, obviously what was happening on the football pitch was starting to gain more and more momentum. You know, so they'd got their first Brazilian player probably about 7 years earlier, and they'd started to, you know, and build on that. And like, as you quite rightly said, they built this community. So actually bringing in Brazilian players was very easy, because they felt at home. They bring their families, their brothers, the sisters, the hairdressers. You know, literally they felt like it was a home from home. And they never, you know, they never complained about the cold or the snow or anything like that. They seem to fit in really well. They seem very comfortable. And it's only when you go to Brazil, you kind of understand why. You know, a lot of these guys come from very impoverished background, so actually they're in luxury where where they were in Donetsk.
So, I think anyway, there's a feeling of, you know, this is my opportunity. I can get my head down, earn my money, and do what I want later on. But the difference is at Shakhtar, there's very much a feeling of, you know, we want to provide an environment for them as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And they were very comfortable, and like I said, obviously they had good salaries, but these were players that had all had very good potential, but probably just a little bit step too far for some of the Western clubs to take a gamble on them. And so we were the perfect springboard. We were that, you know, effectively the shot window for a lot of these players, and we knew that, you know, and so did they. They knew that coming to us was not going to hold them back. Yet, as you quite rightly say, so many of them stayed for quite a good many years. I think Fernandinho was close to seven, you know. So they really enjoyed themselves, you know, and then they enjoyed the environment and the culture they were in, and the fact that they were playing in Champions League pretty much every year and winning. You know, Shakhtar, you know, which was a challenge for me, was the fact that they won nearly all the time. You know, and I used to say that actually it's good to lose every now and again. Like, what are you saying? You must be crazy. I was like, no, it's competition is important. You know, to drive attendance, you need to be coming thinking, you know, this could be an interesting game. If you're winning 5-0 every weekend, I mean, it's boring, isn't it?
It's a tough thing in modern football. Like, I guess with Shakhtar, the difference was that they were trying to establish themselves in the Champions League. Got into the Champions League 3 years in a row, including a quarter final while you were there. You helped to double the turnover, got a load more fans in the stadium, and then hit the end of 2013. And I was in Kiev around that time, in November 2013, when Euromaidan happened. And then that escalates into conflict. I mean, up to the point where you're essentially evacuated in what, May 2014, how does it get from Euromaidan to that point in May 2014, and how quickly did it escalate for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very tricky one in terms of sort of the political landscape, because no one really understood quite what was going on. It's right. Only after the events that people were able to understand what really happened. And there's still a lot of theories, you know, related to why it kicked off. But ultimately, yeah, that happened towards the end of, said, 2013. And we knew there was it was very unsettling in Kiev. But where we were at the time certainly didn't feel very sort of threatening. It sort of gradually started to build, and we started to see some of these groups, you know, who were protesting, you know, in the square, effectively saying, you know, that you know, they wanted to support Russia.
Yeah.
We should support Russia. And then those groups started to become a little bit more militant.
Right.
And then I can't remember the date, I think it was February, was when they basically, it escalated to a point where there was physical action, where they overthrew the regional administration building,
which was opposite your house, right?
Literally right opposite, yeah, just over the road, and basically barricaded themselves in. You know, there was a wall of tires around it. They'd set booby traps. There were guys patrolling it with baseball bats with nails through it, that type of thing. But they did seem to stay very much there. There still wasn't that sort of outreach of violence at that point. So whilst it was sort of, it's a bit shocking for most Ukrainians, it was like, oh, this happens all the time. You know, it was kind of, they're very desensitized to that type of thing. So it kind of put me at ease anyway. But, you know, because of, you know, the organization and obviously, you know, having someone with Akhmetov's political power, you know, we kind of knew what was going on, and there was good, very strong security around the stadium. So I never felt particularly threatened. There were moments that were leading up to kind of the May time where you could start to feel the tension was growing and growing. But you still felt there could be a resolution. Yeah. It was quite interesting. So we were having a lot of meetings with the other expats. Yeah. So there were people from Germany, France, Holland. And thankfully, one of the Swiss guys that was running the Opera Hotel.
Okay.
Not Opera. Donbass Palace Hotel in Donetsk. He was receiving information every day from Swiss intelligence, kind of thing, explaining what was happening, what he shouldn't do, where he shouldn't go, all this type of stuff. So we were kind of monitoring that, and we started to meet more regularly, kind of every day, and updating each other on text, sort of, this is the latest, this is the latest. Mm. And it was quite funny that whole time that we were receiving that. Was I knew obviously the ambassador of, you know, the British ambassador in Kiev at the time, and the only thing we received from him was an invitation to an ambassador's reception dinner in Kiev, which I thought was very British, even though this is a time of almost war here, that come for dinner, everything will be fine, cup of tea. So that was quite funny. But as we got closer to the, I think it was around May 25th, something like that, the elections were due. And we sat down one day and we were just discussing. We said to ourselves, it's going to kick off. Whoever gets in power, the rebels are not going to accept. And it's going to kick off. So I made the decision to sort of pack up as much as I could and go on the fly out on the Saturday. The elections took place on the Sunday, and on Monday kicked off. And
was that when the airport got destroyed?
They blew up the airport, I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. You know, got back and everyone was texting me going, are you still there? I was like, no, I've come back. But I was getting text messages from my friends in Donetsk who were actually still living there during this time, and it was like they were like scenes out of a zombie movie. They weren't things you see on the TV. This were horrific. You know, there was, I remember seeing, you know, a scene sort of dry on the road just towards the airport, and there were his cars and an ambulance just stopped dead in the middle of the road, and there was bodies lying on the ground with bullet holes and blood. And you just thought, what's happened here? How did that escalate that quickly that could possibly happen? So it was, you know, really quite disturbing at the time, and it was only in the sort of ensuing weeks that you started to, you know, people were evacuating, how long, their stories of how they got out of Donetsk, how long it took, and that their houses, you know, had been bombed or shot at and stuff, and it was, oh, it was horrific. But thankfully, all the people I, you know, that I was very close to got out, it was only sort of the months after that that you started to understand this could be tricky. We have no idea when we're going to come back, if indeed ever.
Yeah, I mean, I remember speaking to Dario Cerna about this when I was doing a film about it for The Guardian over in Kiev, I guess, like maybe a year after that. And, it was a really stark image, the fact that, you know, him and his family walked out of their house, and as far as they know, he's got a house there still, car still in the driveway, all his clothes still in it, and you have to move your entire life away. I mean, I guess, like, the fact that the owner has his clout and, you know, they set up administratively in Kiev while playing the games initially, at least in Lviv, meant that it was as smooth as it could have been. How was your transition back to work, and how did you recalibrate your life after that?
Yeah, that was quite difficult, because I was still working for them, because we'd just embarked on we were about to embark on a sort of an internationalisation project, a strategy that would sort of start to develop, that looked at how we could expand our universe, because obviously Ukrainian League was quite limited in terms of sort of commercial opportunities. And
well, it's a full country, isn't it?
Exactly. So there's only so far, you know, the value of sponsorship and advertising is only so much. So we were reaching that ceiling point. We had to find something new to expand out to. And obviously with the number of Brazilians we had, the Brazil market looked like it could be an opportunity. And I'd already started to develop a lot of opportunities there with TV and sponsors and merchandise and that type of thing. So we were just about embarking on that. So actually, there still felt like there was a role there that I would focus really on that international development. So I wasn't actually in Ukraine. I would fly back out to Kiev every now and again, but was very focused on these sort of pre-season tours to the US and Brazil, to see how we could continue to develop. But I think what happened over that sort of probably in 2015, you just started to get that feeling that this was going to go on for quite some time, that we were going to be homeless for quite a while. And I just got to the point where I felt I couldn't really give them any more, you know, because it was very tough. It was very tough for them. You know, they were working out of a hotel in Kiev and trying to make it work. You know, and you've just lost your stadium. You're going to a part of the Ukraine which is really not very Shakhtar, pro Shakhtar.
Yeah. I remember again Cerna saying, you know, that we'd bring Champions League football to Lviv and the fans just boo us. I mean, I can't imagine what it's like going from a stadium which has got like 52,000, really fervent, and all of a sudden you're playing in a stadium in a part of the country that's like not your own, in front of a couple of thousand people. Mm. And if it is full up, they're supporting Bayern Munich.
Yeah, absolutely, exactly. And we knew that, you know, we'd done lots of surveys to understand where our sort of hot spots were throughout Ukraine. And that wasn't one of them. And I was always sort of anti going there, but ultimately, from a stadium point of view, it was our best option, really. And that lasted for, I think they played there for 3 years, I think, 3 years before they moved to Kharkiv. And so, you know, and I, like I said, I got to the point where I felt I'm a wasted resource here, you know, I'm a cost to them. And actually, you know, they don't need me at the moment, because they've got to focus on, you know, getting games played and keeping the football going.
And so this is when you join Sheffield Wednesday. Bring this back to Chris Waddle, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. Back to the UK, and also from a you know, family point of view, it was, you know, I wanted to come back, and the children were getting older, and you know, it becomes more important. You know, when they're really young, they don't remember a lot of it. So it's only my oldest one that really does remember it. You know, me being away at that time. So it was the right time to come back for that. And I wanted to come back for, I'm not someone who wants to go and work in a big Premier League club, where effectively, you know, you're brought in and it's a kind of, okay, you need to get 10% more revenue here or something. It's quite straightforward. I wanted something that's a real challenge.
You're a project guy, aren't you?
Strategy and project. And that's what I'm really interested in. And that's why I love Shakhtar. It was a blank canvas. It was brilliant. And, you know, we created a strategy and implemented it, and that was perfect. You know, it's like a symphony. But you know, the same sort of feeling I had for Wednesday was that, you know, it's one of these sleeping giants. There were probably three or four clubs that I thought really attracted me. You know, you've got your Nottingham Forest, your Leeds, Sheffield Wednesday, these once huge clubs with still a very large fan base and an even more larger dormant fan base, where there could be so much potential to grow them. An opportunity came up through an agent who was working with them, and I got to meet the chairman, and we agreed on me going up there, and it was, you know, I absolutely loved it. I really loved Wednesday as a club. It was a, you know, wonderful place to be. The people were wonderful.
So you brought a lot of stuff in house at the club as well. Obviously, there are a lot of clubs that have challenges in the Championship, especially in the FFP era, and you got the club generating a lot of its own business essentially by getting a company to produce its own strips, by Sheffield Wednesday branded beer. I mean, funnily enough, not a lot of people would compare Sheffield Wednesday and AFC Wimbledon, but knowing that, I can kind of see the straight line of how you get from there to here.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. I think people, I've always taken a much more sort of business approach to football clubs. I think that a lot of football clubs don't look outside the box enough.
Yeah.
Too many clubs kind of copy what each other's doing, follow the same sort of generic way of working and the way they operate,
rather than realise the properties that you actually have and can exploit.
100%. And that's it. And I think, you know, there's huge opportunities to be had with expanding out, utilising the brand. And I think you've got a captive audience, you know, particularly with some of these clubs that have huge fan bases. They want to be loyal. You know, if the product's good, why wouldn't they buy it? If you had a taxi company, why wouldn't they use it? You know, if you've got beer, why wouldn't they drink it? If you can get it in pubs and you can buy it in bottles, why wouldn't you? The club strips, you know, yes, there's an argument that people say, well, you know, yeah, they quite like having the branded logo, but actually they're made in the same factories, you know, the branded goods are, you know, the quality's the same. But actually you make a lot more margin, you know, and so there's ways that you can but you make more money, but you've got to really think outside the box, and that's something that I want to bring to Wimbledon as well, because I think, you know, it's the type of club where that, I think, would go down quite well with the fans.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
And so we are here in the boardroom at AFC Wimbledon. Now, you come in as Wimbledon Chief Operating Officer in March 2018. It was quite a long interview process, so you knew you were in the mix for quite a while.
Yeah. No, I think I had...
We're talking months, aren't we?
Yeah. I'm trying to remember how many interviews. I think it was about three.
Right.
I think I had three interviews here. Yeah, it was a couple of months. Good couple of months.
Yeah.
And I was you know, over the moon when I got it, and it was quite funny because actually I remember when I was talking to the recruitment consultant, he sort of first said to me, are you sure you want to go to League One? I thought you'd want to go upwards.
Yeah.
And I said no, I said that's not me. I said I want something that's a challenge that I can leave a mark on, that I can really impress on.
And you already get the club because you're familiar with the area and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So, the first house I was in with my wife was on Hayden's Road.
Right.
So my eldest son was born in St George's, and actually one of my first clients in my sports marketing agency was the GRA down at Wimbledon.
Right.
So we did some events down there with them. So, yeah, I was quite familiar, and I'd obviously watched the story from afar. I had a guy in the office who was a massive AFC Wimbledon fan. So he used to come in all the time talking about AFC Wimbledon.
And there's not really another type of AFC Wimbledon fan. No. You're either in or you're not.
That's right. And he used to talk a lot about it, always come in with his shirt on and stuff. He was so proud of them. And he was a great guy. And so that's, it's a large part of how I got to know them more. And actually I did have some conversations when I had the agency with Keith McGuinness, one of the commercial guys in the early days, and we sort of discussed with him about how we could help sort of from a commercial point of view. But I said, he had very little budget in those days, so we just didn't find a way forward, unfortunately. But I obviously live in Epsom as well, so it is my local club. And I think what it was, one day one thing really got to me, and I was at my kid's school, and all of a sudden Chelsea rocked up and started delivering the PE sessions,
right,
on behalf of the school, which is quite common, and doing after school clubs. And I remember being massively incensed by that, and I was trying to think, that's not right. This isn't a Chelsea area. This should be a Wimbledon area. Wimbledon should be in here. And I was really angry about it. And I remember it was always in the back of my mind, thinking, I understand Chelsea. Obviously, I've got no issue with Chelsea, but it just felt like, that this should be an AFC Wimbledon, area, and Wimbledon should be in here, and that just sort of grew and grew in the back of my mind. So when this opportunity came up, it was one of the sort of first things that sprung to mind again, thinking, there's definitely something to be done here. There is a huge, much larger market than the club currently, reaches out to. And I still believe there is. And so for me, it was, I knew there was the potential here, the potential with a new stadium, the potential with the brand, the potential with the story. Ultimately, it was, when you put it all together, I knew that this would be a great opportunity, a great challenge.
I guess my next question would be, how different did it feel to walking into another club? Because here, I mean, it's quite a small club. It's quite a close-knit community. And everyone, as you say, knows the Wimbledon story. But when you walk into here, and Kings Meadow is essentially a non-league ground, but you can feel how invested everyone is in it at the moment you arrive. So how much more responsibility do you feel, knowing that it's the fans' actual club?
Yeah, a lot more. I think what's interesting is, you know, again, one of the other reasons why I was keen to come here was that ability to do it in the right way.
Right.
You know, so I'd been at two clubs where there was a lot of investment from the owner.
Mm.
And there isn't that level here. And that's why everything has to be done properly. You know, we have to be very, have very strict financial control.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do that. I wanted to do things in the right way. Mm. I wanted to be in charge of an organisation and a football club that is sustainable and does things in the right way, but it's still successful.
Mm.
That's the ultimate story to tell, isn't it? So for me, that was one of the key things that really drove me. But I think, you know, I believe that that's more possible because of the fan ownership and the fact that there are so many more fans that are heavily invested in terms of the club, you know, and in terms of not just emotionally invested in the club, but the fact that they give their time. You know, this club could not have got to where it's got to without time and investment from those fans, you know, as volunteering their help.
Yeah.
And that's been such a key part of it. And actually, it's a key part of maintaining that sustainability, you know, because if you've got to be paying to bring consultants and all this sort of stuff in, you know, it just eats into your operating revenue. Yeah.
So did you feel that having come from a corporate background into a club that was run across those sort of guidelines and principles, that it took you a bit of a while to get people's trust?
Yeah, and I think it still is. You know, I think ultimately people are looking at me to deliver the stadium, and I absolutely believe we will and want to.
Yeah.
You know, that's the challenge, and it's not something I take lightly.
Yeah.
That's why I've got so many bags under my eyes, and my hair's a lot greyer than it was when I first joined. You know, because to me, that's something that's what pleases me. Is, you could say it's a bit of an ego thing, but that's what I want. I want fans to be really excited and happy and pleased with me that we've achieved that goal, because I know how big going back to Wimbledon for this club is. It's everything, and you know, I want to help them achieve that, and I know I can.
Well, Plough Lane has been the dominant subject, really, ever since you were here. It was always really been the top line of your job. Of course, you commuted your job to CEO in April 2019. I guess they were always looking towards you for that, because Eric Samuelson, the previous CEO, had been looking to step down for a couple of years. Just how much has Plough Lane dominated your workload?
It has been my workload. I think that's the tricky bit. I think you know, you've got to remember that just running a football club in normal terms,
yeah,
you know, one of this size where you don't have huge resource, is a challenge.
Yeah.
When you throw on top of that the project of building a new stadium and everything that goes with that, from the funding to the planning to construction issues, it's a major undertaking. And actually, I said, whilst it has been very tough for me, it's also, you know, been incredibly tough for a lot of the other guys involved. You know, Mark Davis, Ed Leake,
who have the guys who work for the Don's Trust, who have actual jobs and have to work on this in their spare time.
Absolutely, I mean, it can't be underestimated. I mean, Mark has been phenomenal. You know, I really could not have got through this without his support. I mean, it's been amazing. He, you know, throughout the summer, he was taking one day a week holiday, effectively, to, you know, to work on this. You know, that pulling together, and that you know, he knew this was a job that had to be done, and did what he needed to do in order to help and support me with it. So you know, I'll be forever thankful for that, and so should the fans. I mean, he's been outstanding, and it hasn't been easy. It has been a real challenge, you know, from every angle, but we are getting there, and we're confident we will.
And it's not been easy in the last couple of months as well. I mean, you talked about Mark and Ed fronting the Don's Trust special general meeting back in December, and it was difficult for them because they had to talk about there being an 11 million funding shortfall for the stadium, which I guess took a lot of people by surprise. Shocked, concerned about what would happen in the future. There was the possibility of external investment. brought up by Mark and Ed as a possible way of helping to bridge that shortfall. And from some sections of the fans, something I myself was not happy about, sat there, the idea of giving away a part of the club that the fans have worked so hard to build. How long had you known about such a big potential shortfall?
I think we'd always known about there was going to be a shortfall. I think that wasn't hidden from anyone. I think at all the previous AGMs we'd discussed about that. Obviously, at the one before we'd discussed, we'd voted on the fact that could we rate, would the Don's Trust agree to raising the potential loan amount to 11 million?
Yeah.
So they knew it was a reality, effectively. I guess for some people it was a surprise, but there's also quite a large number of people who were, regularly coming to the AGMs who were kind of probably a bit more aware that there was still that funding gap.
Do you think the club has had an issue communicating this sort of stuff? I mean, I know there are fans out there that feel that.
Mm. Yes and no. I mean, and we sort of tried to explain this before, I think, and Mark certainly did, was that we were caught in a very difficult situation where we've got to be careful when we're talking about how much debt, what the situation is with this, because it makes it more difficult from, lending point of view.
In terms of investor confidence.
Absolutely. So we need to, we couldn't always be completely transparent about everything that was happening, because it actually would go against us when we go to market. Mm. So, and that's still the case. Mm. We have had a few issues where we've had some lenders that have turned us down as a result of some of the stuff that's gone out. Right. So we know we have to be careful with it. But yeah, look, we are, I think, in an ideal world, with the resource, we'd be able to have gone through this in a much more sort of smoother way. But we are very much under it.
Yeah.
And we don't have a huge amount of resource to have lots of consultants and stuff working for us. Right. That just eats more into our budget, and every penny we've got to try and put into the stadium fund. So we can always, with hindsight, look back at things and say we could have communicated that better, but at the same time we don't want to be shouting it from the rooftops.
Sure.
So it's striking that balance, really, and we knew that some people would be unhappy, and we've got to sort of take that on the chin as part of a process to move us forward. So It's one of those things, really.
And I guess the main thing to come out of that SGM in December is that the fact that it really did bring out what people would do to avoid a situation where part of the club was sold. So what I think has been clear to me and a lot of other Wimbledon fans is the atmosphere around the debate of how we're going to take it forward has changed so much since then, because people have said, we know what, we're going to find a solution, because Wimbledon fans always find a solution. When the team was, when the club was moved to Milton Keynes, we found a solution in creating this club in the first place. And that resourcefulness of the fans and the desire to have their own club has really come forward again. The Plough Lane bond issue was something that came out of that meeting. It's been launched this week. Tell us a bit about the Plough Lane bond and what a successful bond issue would mean to the future of the stadium project.
Absolutely. So quite right, the bond, what a great initiative, it really is, and like I said, finding that solution is so key. Yeah. And actually, when you look at other football clubs, you're looking at owners who, they just pump their money in. Yeah. And actually, in effect, what we've got is a number of fans who are now doing the same thing, and the need to, in order for us to, that's football, unfortunately, the rising cost of football is massive. Mm. So it's brilliant to see that's taking place, and the fans are taking that responsibility on their own shoulders to do that. Mm. Not only from the great group of fans that decided that they really wanted to take that initiative and bring it to the Don's Trust and to make it happen. But also for the fans to actually go, I need to invest my money in this to help the club get the stadium built, and that's brilliant. That is unlike other clubs. That's what sets us apart, and it's a great initiative. So yeah, so the bond launched, like I said, the weekend. When we did the research prior to launch, obviously it was a great response. you know, it was showing, you know, somewhere around 3.5 million in terms of pledges, which gave us really great confidence. So, you know, we really ploughed ahead. We had to bring together a lot of things very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Full credit to the group that did.
Because we've got to underline for people who aren't aware that there is a time limit, isn't there?
Absolutely, yeah. We are constrained with time. And that was the issue before Christmas as well. You know, we've always understood the funding gap. The issue is that we were getting closer to the point where we needed it. And that's why we had to come out at that point to say, look, we're getting closer. We don't have it yet, but we need to tell you, because we can't tell you in February, like the day before we need it. You know, that is just not acceptable. So I think that's where a lot of the sort of, you know, sort of the issues came from, and people were upset. But that's really where we were. We didn't have little choice. Mm. You know, we had to warn people of the fact that everything wasn't secured yet, but we were hopeful that it would be. So obviously the bond, you know, sort of was born out of that. So I'd say it was actually a very positive, you know, I'd really try to look at the silver lining here, and actually it was a really positive thing that we did come out that time, that fans went, right, we're going to take action.
And refocused fans, I
absolutely
guess.
And they seem to be, you know, really focused on it and getting behind it, and it's brilliant to see. And you know, now launched, I think today they were close to the 600,000 mark already, after just a few days. So really great numbers there, very encouraging to see. The bond, effectively people have the opportunity to buy it either over 5, 10 or 20 years. And also the wonderful thing is that they can choose their interest rate. Now obviously from our point of view, we hope that people take the longest term over the lowest, you know, interest, if at all. You know, that obviously improves our situation, because the only issue with a bond is that you know, if it's 5 years, you're just kicking the can down the road a little bit further. But the further we can do it, and the less the repayment, then the better it is. But what it really means is it reduces that overall debt that we have, and means that our loan will be smaller, meaning our repayments will be smaller on a yearly basis. But it also means we're more likely to get a loan. It makes getting a loan much better if the loan is smaller. So it can only be positive, and the more we can raise, the better it is. So if we hit 3.5 million that's been pledged, brilliant. If we can push to 5, that would be absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. And really does mean a lot in terms of, it gets us really close to getting the stadium built.
And it's not just about the stadium, but it's about the team that's going to be in it, because obviously until you get the drip down of the improved commercial facilities and all that sort of stuff that's going to be at the new stadium, conference and banqueting, all that sort of stuff, I mean, the team has been playing above its weight for punching above its weight for a couple of years, hasn't it? There's a lot of clubs with a lot of money in League One, and it's not cheap to run the team, is it?
No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, everyone knows our budget's one of the lowest in the division, and unfortunately with a high loan, it will still be like that. And that's why we want to get the loan as small as possible. And obviously the sort of interest repayments on a bond as small as possible, so that our repayments aren't impacting too much on our budget. And that's the scenario we want to get to. Another factor in this is, as you quite rightly said, timing wise. So obviously we need to start making decisions in February. We need to really understand that we've got the money to be able to sign the JCT that we have, so that we can maintain the build schedule and program, which, you know, has actually moved forward from where we were. So it's a really good sign for us. We're looking now towards the end of August, which is a really positive step for us. So we you know, we need to be able to see where this bond can get to as soon as possible, and hopefully the loan element, which we are, I believe, very close to. I've had some conversations with the broker yesterday and today. I'm hoping there'll be some good news over the next week on that. I can't guarantee, but
sure,
as much as we can. So we're pushing forward.
What will it mean to you all being good, that first home game in New Plough Lane?
Oh, it'd be incredible. I mean, I can't imagine what it will feel like for the fans have been waiting for this for 18 years. Mm. I mean, that's something else. But for me personally, I mean, just for me to deliver that on that expectation is going to mean so much to me as well, because I've been put in this place of responsibility. I want to take that responsibility and I want to deliver it for people, because just to see how happy people will be is something you can't describe, you know. Mm. Just also from a point of view of where I can finally relax a little bit, it would be quite something, you know.
I need cushioned seats there.
Oh my word. Yeah, I'm going to need a bed just to lie down after this one. But it has taken a lot out of all of us, mm. you know, that have been involved in it. And I think, you know, the moment we get that, you know, we're able to sign that JCT, because we know we've got the funding in place, whether it's between the bond or the loan, you know, that we can say, right, sign, this is getting, the full scheme's being built, I'll breathe a massive sigh of relief for about 5 minutes and then I will turn around and I will look at my list of other things, of the operational stuff that we need to, decisions that we need to make, that we're making at the moment, but I need to focus on, and I will just head down ploughing on with those things. So the day it's actually delivered and built, the day afterwards, probably after that first day, will be a really big day. Yeah,
will be the day after, because there'll be a hangover to contend with first, of course.
There absolutely will. Yeah.
Finally, where, all being well with that, do you see FC Wimbledon in 5 years, and where do you see yourself in 5 years?
I want to be here, absolutely. This is not just a project to come and build the stadium. You know, I wanted to come here, yes, to get that stadium built, to do things that this club probably maybe didn't think was possible, to really put it on another level. You know, a lot of people talk about where this club can go, and actually that's, to be honest, I have my own opinions, but as I said before, you know, this is not my club, you know, and this is something that we need to decide from a strategic point of view. As I said, I'm a strategist, I love strategy. Yeah. What I want to do is put in place a strategic plan that is agreed on democratically by the majority. You say, right, we want to be in the, we want to aim for the championship. Yeah. That's where you want to go. Okay, let's go. You know, it's down to me to find the pathway to get there. That's what I do.
Well, that's right, because you did say actually at that meeting back in December, I think people were quite surprised at first that you were quite quiet for a lot of it, and you said, well, it's your club and it's my job to deliver what you want.
And it is. It's not my club, you know, and people need to decide. I think that's the big question that this club really needs to make is to come up with the answer of what do we want to be? Where do we want to be? How ambitious do we want to be? That's the big question. You know, people talk about sort of fan ownership and this external investment type question, but actually largely the bigger question is, where do we want to be? You know, if it is to be, go as far as we can with fan ownership, fine, that's the strategy. Great. If people say no, we want to get up to the Championship and get to the Premier League, well then people have got to think different. It's a different conversation, isn't it? So for me, I just want that question answered. So, you know, we did have some discussions a year ago, sort of, you know, let's go through a strategic consultation, but we just sort of, with everything that was going on with the stadium, it was, let's get the stadium built, you know, and then have that discussion, which I think is right. You know, first strategy was, we understood building the stadium is going to help us bring in more revenue and give us that opportunity to go to another level. Then we've got to decide, you know, how far that is. One thing that is certain is that by making that decision to build a new, more expensive stadium, does show a level of ambition.
Yeah.
You know, we can't rest on our laurels and just sort of go, okay, well, let's behave like this and slide back down the leagues and go into non-league with a facility like that. That will not be comfortable. So we have to be ambitious, but I think by making that decision that we wanted to build this kind of size stadium in back in Wimbledon kind of says that to a certain extent. So, I'm really looking forward to that part of it once we've done the stadium, and actually let's ask that question, let's all agree on it, and let's go and have some fun.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.